and welcome to Echoes from the Shore, Lessons from Diverse Marine Values, a new podcast from the Diverse Marine Values Project, funded by the Sustainable Management of Marine Resources Programme. For 3 years, the Diverse Marine Values team has been exploring the many ways people value the sea and how these values can be integrated more fully in marine management in the UK. This podcast will give you hints and tips about how to use a diverse suite of methods to understand the relationship between people in the ocean, coast and sea. You'll be hearing about some of the insights, challenges and findings that the team has uncovered, with lessons for you to use these methods in your own research and practice. We hope this podcast series can help to develop capacity across the UK's marine research community and foster new pathways for inclusion of diverse values within marine policy. I'm Dr. Emma McKinley, a senior research fellow at Cardiff University.
And I'm Dr. Victoria Leslie, a research fellow at the University of Portsmouth. And in each episode, we'll be initiating a conversation with researchers from the Diverse Marine Values team to understand more about working on this unique project.
For this episode, we're joined by Dr. Catherine Federa from the University of Glasgow. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
Would you like to start off the podcast episode by telling us a little bit about yourself and also your role in the Diverse Marine Values Project?
Sure. And it's great to be here. It's great to be back on the project. I am now at University of Glasgow in the School of Law, which kind of came about through my work on the Diverse Values Project, which is awesome. It's great that one thing leads to another. So my role on the project, so I came into it quite late, working on Work Package 4, which is all about decision making. And we were looking at kind of mapping a series of case study decisions from across England, Scotland and Wales to really kind of understand how these marine decisions were made, the values that you could see within the process, and how you could potentially get more values to be considered within those processes. So essentially, I came in as a social scientist and marine regulation specialist. I did that.
So, Kat, in terms of what kind of methods you used throughout the project, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, about your kind of approaches that you adopted.
Sure. So I guess from a kind of purely methods perspective, everything that I did was kind of documentary analysis. We didn't really have time to go out and do any interviews, although we did do a little bit of validation with stakeholders. So essentially what we were doing was looking at the kind of decision documents that are in the public domain for decisions such as the marine license and planning permission for the South Sea Coastal Defence Project, looking at how that decision was made, looking at all of the assessment documents, and then kind of following the trail backwards to try and find out where the kind of the first need for these projects, for these decisions, appeared. So we collected all that information, mapped the decision points using Miro, and then it was really quite iterative of just doing lots of reading and trying to figure out, whose values and what values were incorporated into decisions, where and how.
Catherine, that's great. How did you decide on what decisions to focus on for the project? We've heard a lot from other speakers and other guests on the podcast series about the importance of understanding how to integrate the different values that we've been exploring in the project into the decision-making process. And you were really looking at it from another perspective, looking at how decisions are made. How did you decide which decisions to explore and to focus on?
You see, for me, this was quite an easy job because I took over this role from a previous academic. The decisions were pretty much set. We knew that we were working within the three test sites. So we had Portsmouth, Shetland and Chepstow. Now, when I came onto the project, the Shetland decisions had been mapped, so my work there was pretty much done, which was lovely. It's always good to be kind of working with other people on these things. But generally for the for each of the test sites, we wanted to look at different scales. So we were looking at something either kind of local and national, local and regional. In the case of Portsmouth, it was local and hyper-local. So looking at the main sea defence decision, but also one of the sub-frontages, as they were called. So one of the really small parts of the project to see if there was any difference between the decision making and the values at those different scales. I think the only big decision that we really made quite late on was to incorporate a bylaw decision in the Chepstow test site. When we first looked at it, we very nearly discounted it because we didn't think we'd get any data from it. It ended up being the most valuable of our case studies. So yeah, glad we did that.
Could you talk us through that case study a little bit, please? I think it'd be really interesting to kind of hear some of your insights and why that was such an interesting case study to explore.
Sure. So the decision we looked at for the Welsh bylaws, it was a set of bylaws to I'm going to start this again because I've gone off on a tangent.
Okay. That's good.
There
Okay,
you go.
take your time. Mm-hmm.
So for the Welsh bylaws, we were looking at a set of bylaws that control angling activity for two rivers in Wales. That's the Wye and Usk. And they really were quite simple instruments. So bylaws are used to control fishing activity. And in this case, it was essentially to mandate the use of a practice called catch and release, where you catch fish and you put it back again. Now, this practice had been used voluntarily in the Wye and Usk for years. And essentially, these bylaws that we were looking at were just extending ones that were expiring. So you're like, so why is there so much controversy about this? Why are we looking at this? And when we started digging into it a bit more, we discovered that actually the case that we were looking at, the Wye and Usk bylaws, didn't mention catch and release at all. So again, the kind of plot thickens. Why are people so up in arms about this decision? Why is there all of this information online about it? A little bit more investigation, and as I said, that kind of iterative approach of kind of working backwards, where's this come from? There's another big set of bylaws called the All Wales bylaws that were drafted and consulted on a couple of years prior to this decision. And it's in there that essentially all angling on all rivers in Wales becomes a mandatory catch and release. And this decision got really kind of controversial. It went to a local inquiry. And in that local inquiry, there was a real case of a kind of argument or a debate between, on the one hand, the scientific evidence, you know, we need to protect salmon rivers, we need to protect salmon. And on the other hand, the local anglers saying, well, hang on a sec, we already do this. We already do this practice. You're not listening to us. You're not coming onto the ground. We know the rivers better than you. And essentially, when we kind of went through this, we kind of came to the conclusion that both sides were right, but from very different perspectives. So on the one hand, you've got the scientific case, which is looking at the river in one way. It's very kind of objective. You know, salmon stocks have gone down. We need to put in measures to boost them back up again. Bylaws will do that. This practice will do that. But on the other hand, you've got local people that are like, well, look, if you come down to the river, you'll understand what it's like to be in the river and to fish. And, you know, we've also seen salmon stocks go down, but we know it's not us because we haven't changed our practices. And of course, we also want to protect salmon because it's our livelihood and our hobby. So I guess, yeah, the decision itself was very small, but it just kind of goes to show that all of the values that get into these decisions can be really complicated and really kind of crunchy. And we found that really interesting.
I was going to say, having seen some of the maps that you've produced for the decision-making process, they are these very, you know, complex, layered, and it's really interesting to see them visually as well, to see the process. But also take place over sometimes quite a long period of time. I was wondering if through the mapping process, was there anything that you uncovered that you found surprising, at all across any of the test sites?
Yes, I mean, I think the most surprising thing was really that case from Wales. But another thing that really surprised me was the use of kind of what we call externalities in our research, which is things that kind of come into the process from outside of it and how they help to shape the process that the decision makers are going through. And I mean, my background is as a decision maker. I used to work for the Marine Management Organization as a marine in the marine licensing team. So I thought I knew marine decisions. But I think what surprised me, kind of on reflection, was how my view of the role of law and legislation changed. We often kind of think of laws as stopping you from doing things. In the case of the salmon rivers, the laws are there saying you must not hurt salmon. Great, and it does that, but it also provides a really strong value statement. We think salmon are so important that we're going to protect them in law. And that means that as a decision maker, that decision's already been made for you. You don't have to reopen that argument. So I think that was one of the things that surprised me, was how these kind of externalities really influence the process in quite an opaque way. We tend to just see them as, and to use another technical word from the kind of concepts that we were using, we see them as atmospherics. They're just the way things are. And in many ways, that's good, because it really kind of helps define the decision that you're making. It's not complete anarchy. You're not opening up everything else. But that said, if that's the case, we need to also be able to provide ways for people to challenge those kind of externalities and find avenues of kind of approaching the right people to consider changing them if that change is needed.
I think it's really interesting within the project, actually, that we've been looking at diverse marine values, and I think when a lot of us talk about it's kind of framed around the values held by communities, but actually the research that's been done through the different work packages has actually explored values attached to and maybe inherent within the more than human, but also through the work that you've just described, the values that are inherent within a process and within decisions. Already, like it's not necessarily just about understanding the diverse values that a community might hold towards the salmon, for example. It's about understanding the values that have already been placed on that object or thing or part of the environment or the part of the system. And I think perhaps that's something that was definitely new to me, really something for me to think about a little bit differently, because a lot of my work has focused very much on the people bit of it. And I think that has been really, really valuable part of kind of working with you and really ensuring that we integrated that aspect into the project. How has process, kind of that aspect, been integrated into the work that you've been doing?
It's a really interesting question, Emma, and I would just kind of like add to what you've said about community there, and kind of challenge with, well, community at what scale?
Absolutely. Such an important point.
You know what I mean? Like the laws of a country are set on behalf of a community, and technically, because they're determined through a democratic process, they the community helps form them. So I think that's a, it's a really important point to make sure that the people have access to decision-making processes at the appropriate level. And when I say appropriate, it's what can their values influence at a given time? Because otherwise, as I say, we couldn't get anything done. What was your original question about process?
It was just how process fed into the work you were doing. And I know that you've been working a lot around this concept of process literacy, I suppose. So it'd be interesting to kind of bring that into this discussion and ask you a little bit about that, really.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, process is kind of at the heart of everything I do. As I say, I'm a regulator more than anything else. I like having a process to follow. And I kind of come from this kind of town planning background before the marine regulation stuff, where these processes have been designed for a reason, and they've developed over many, many years. So they are trying to do the best that they can. And I think when it comes to process literacy, it's a case of trying to understand that, and communicate that both to the community so they understand what it is they're commenting on, what their comments can and can't change. And I'll give an example of that in a minute. But also for decision makers themselves, because I do think, a lot of kind of council departments and civil service departments are stretched for resource and time. And I mean, it took me months to map these processes. It's not the type of thing that you can do in a kind of day-to-day, in a day-to-day world. You can't kind of go, well, I wonder where this development idea came from. Let me go back through all of the documents and find the first possible mention of it. And in terms of that example of engaging with communities in the kind of in I say the right way, that's very normative, isn't it? But in the most valuable way for them. This is important for a couple of reasons. I think if we're going out to consult, or if decision makers are going out to consult with local communities, they need to be able to explain what it is that they're actually asking of communities. And in the case of the South Sea Coastal Defence Scheme, going out to communities and say, so what would you like from this seawall? You're obviously going to get a lot of comments that aren't directly related to that development. You're going to get comments about residents parking, for instance, which is a really important issue for local people. But because of the way that the legislation works and the regulations work, you can't really consider that in a planning decision. It's not part of that decision that you're making. It's important to local people, but it's not part of the decision that you're looking at. So process literacy for me is about explaining the boundaries of what it is you're asking. And it's important because there's nothing more off-putting for or alienating for communities to go and give their time and their energy to talk to local decision makers about issues that they care about, only to get that letter back saying, thank you, we've considered your comment and discovered that they're not relevant for our decision. It's like, why would you do it again? Why would you go back and engage again if you've already given your time and it hasn't gone anywhere, and all you've got is a letter saying thanks for your thank, basically thanks but no thanks. So if we understand processes better, I think the gold standard would be for decision makers to be going into those situations. And if somebody does come up and say, yeah, well, the real problem around here is that, there's nobody emptying the bins or something like that. Rather than saying, well, we'll take your comments into consideration, being really honest and saying, look, we can't consider this within the decision that we're looking at. However, if you talk to this department at the council, they should be able to help you. And doing that kind of signposting, it does take extra effort, but I think in the long run, if we're serious about engaging local communities in decisions, it's a really important exercise.
That's really interesting. I was going to ask, in terms of the work that you've been doing on the project and the mapping, but also the analysis that's come from that, would you say what worked particularly well? Do you feel that this was as a process was useful for the Diverse Marine Values project? I wonder if you could highlight some of the, I don't know, particular successes of using the mapping approach.
I think one of the biggest successes was being able to talk to the wider team about the decisions that we were looking at. I think everybody kind of understands that there is a challenge with engaging local communities in particular, and getting their values involved in the process, the decision-making process. But until you've actually kind of mapped that process and understood why it's done in the way that it is, and what its limitations are, you can't really have those conversations about how to make it better. Because otherwise, and I think this was something that I was really keen to kind of guard against throughout all my work, was all the fantastic work that the rest of the team were doing, particularly on the arts-based methods. I didn't really want to kind of imagine a future where, these methods are being used, but the data that's coming for the from them still can't really kind of get incorporated into the process because there's a mismatch. So it's about, for me, it was about Yeah, mapping the processes so that we can then identify, you know what, this would be a really good place to potentially use some forum theatre, for instance. We could use that to help train decision makers or local communities to help them understand the processes that they're going through. So yeah, I think that was a success.
You've mentioned the arts-based research methods. I wondered if you could reflect on your own experience of working with other members of a team, and maybe on your kind of transdisciplinary experiences.
Yeah, I mean, transdisciplinarity is hard. But it's really rewarding. And I mean, I have a couple of reflections on that. Just I'll do the working practices first, I guess. I mean, throughout the project, I became more and more academic, it's clear to say. I started on this project working in consultancy, and then I ended up working in academia. And that allowed me a different lens to view things from. It's definitely kind of an opening up of my thinking about, yeah, how other people view the world. And that kind of came through as well in this whole kind of idea of process literacy. How do people view it? Because, you know, I'm sitting here as a planner, regulator person going, yeah, but it's really obvious. It's really obvious that's what law's doing, but it's not obvious to everybody else. And I think just to tell a little anecdote on that, it was a meeting quite late on in the project where we were I think we were brainstorming for the exhibition, and I kept using the word receptor. It's like, we need to consider this, you know, we need to like mark out all the receptors. And one of our arts-based colleagues said, I'm going to stop you there. I have no idea what you're talking about. Because for me, the word receptor is really kind of obvious. You know, it's kind of the topics that you have in an environmental impact assessment, the things that are affected by development. But for them, that wasn't the case at all. So I think that's probably the biggest learning about transdisciplinarity is checking in constantly with your team and not being afraid to stop and say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Because you probably do. They're just using words that you don't quite understand or you don't use in the same way. So that's been a really kind of valuable experience. Yeah, what was the first part of your question? God, I'm slow today.
No. Well, it was about the transdisciplinary working, but it also about how you had individually collaborated with other members of a team.
Ah, yes. And on the arts-based methods as well. I remember now. So I did have the opportunity to take part in some forum theatre, which was an incredibly valuable experience. And I realised that I've basically done it before, but under a different guise. So during my PhD, I did a lot of teaching on the town planning undergraduate course at Newcastle University. And one thing we did with our third years was to do mock development mock committee meetings, which is very kind of similar to that kind of approach of just using theatre and role play to train people in the skills that they need when they, you know, when they join the world of town planning, essentially. But doing the forum theatre exercise with Jonathan Potts, master's students, was fantastic. I mean, firstly, it's great fun. But secondly, again, it's that you think you have a good idea of how people view decisions and processes and development in general. And then you engage with other people and they come up with wildly different ideas, which are all completely valid. And yeah, I think that's probably the biggest learning from transdisciplinary working is just being open to other people's ideas.
That openness has definitely been a theme that we've seen carry through the podcast episodes that we've recorded. And it's, I think, being open and responsive and adaptive has really come through as being kind of quite central to the success of transdisciplinarity, which is really great to kind of hear that coming through from your experiences as well. For our final question, if there was somebody who wanted to do more work on understanding how decisions are made, understanding how to identify where there might be entry points for innovation or new ways of thinking or integrating diverse values, what would be the main advice that you would give to someone who is interested in doing the kind of work that you've done?
Don't assume that you know anything would be my advice. Don't assume that you know the process. Be really curious, follow leads. It's the type of researching that I love, and I'm really fortunate to be doing it again at Glasgow, of just trying to understand the complexities of a system that on paper seems to be really kind of really objective and formal, but actually it's all just a bit of a mess. And that's great. And it's built up in the way that it has because people are genuinely trying to do better each time they do it. I would say just go into it with an open mind. Don't presume anything and follow your nose.
And always assume people are trying to do better. I really like that. It's a really nice way to end this episode. Thank you, Catherine, very, very much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. If you're interested to learn more about the Diverse Marine Values Project, please visit our website, which we'll link in the show notes, and tune in again for the next episode in this podcast series.
The Sustainable Management of UK Marine Resources Programme is funded by the Natural Environment Research Council and the Economic and Social Research Council. The Diverse Marine Values Project is one of six projects funded to explore new ways of forging partnerships and approaches to marine management in the UK. For further details, please visit the SMMR website.